Hello, everyone. This is your co-host, Stu, and I'm here with the paranormalist, Patty Wilson. Patty, how are you today?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Not too bad. You look tired, though.
I am a little tired. It's been very busy. I know we've taken a couple weeks off. We've had a lot of stuff going on, both you and I, and wanted to tell our listeners and viewers that we're sorry we had to miss them, and we did miss them. But we're really glad to be back, and we thank you for your patience and kindness while we were taking care of some family things.
Well said. If you are watching this on any kind of video platform that gives you the option to click the subscribe button that's down below, please do that if you haven't subscribed already. Click the bell or whichever mechanism is there to let you know that we have new content. We also have our link tree. The link is going to be below in the description, and that has links to pretty much all the things paranormal related, our Facebook pages, email address, and if we ever come up with anything else to put in there, it'll be in there too. So with that, I'm done. Your turn.
Okay. So we're going to talk about ghosts of the Vietnam War. I have a dear friend who had been in the war, and he used to talk about things once in a while with me. And I was thinking about him recently and was doing a little bit of reading, and I was shocked to find out how many people died in that war. I had no clue. We think of the Vietnam War, and we probably have no context other than things like maybe the movie, the TV show MASH. But it was a real war. It wasn't a police conflict. It was deadly and devastating. There were over 2 million civilians who were killed, over a million South Vietnamese who died. There were literally hundreds of thousands of other people who were injured or died. Not only the United States was involved, but Canada, France, England, I believe Australia as well, and a few other places. And they all sent soldiers over. So this was a big deal. This was what we're seeing playing out now in the Ukraine, is what was going on. But our soldiers were there as well. It's not just the Ukrainians. It would have been as though the Ukrainians needed help and we sent in a committee of tens of thousands of soldiers from different countries.
Yeah, I guess so being here in the U.S., I mean, we don't think much about that. That, you know, it wasn't just us.
No, it wasn't just us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it changed the fabric of this nation forever, whether we realize it or not. It did. And I was just really amazed by the amount of stories I came up with on the paranormal from Vietnam. And they're all from that time period of the police action, as they called it. And there are literally hundreds and hundreds of them. So I just thought I would share some of them. I found some of them fascinating. And if everybody's interested, we may even go even further in another episode. So to start out, as I said, there were so many civilians who died that it was easy to understand that there would be a lot of impact in the civilian community. Literally, an entire nation of people got displaced, and they were just moving randomly from place to place, trying to find a place that was safe to put down roots again. And it wasn't safe anywhere, frankly. The story is about a farmer, and he was literally subsistence living. He was working in the rice paddies and trying to make raise enough food and help make enough money and what have you to just survive. That's all there was, just survival. Something in his stomach at the end of the day was his blessing. And he was on his way down to the rice paddies to work one morning, and he sees in the distance a woman sitting on a stump of a tree along the edge of the dirt road, and there's children behind her. And as he gets closer, he begins to think she looks very familiar, but it's still quite a distance away. And as he gets closer yet, he realizes this is his wife and their three children who had died a year ago in the bombings that had happened. And he's shocked. His wife looks angry and sad. His children's eyes are almost accusatory as they look at him. And as he speaks, is it asking her, what is wrong? Why are you here? She and the children just disappear. In their belief system, this means that they aren't at rest, they aren't at peace. Something has happened, and he realizes that he needs to do something. So he makes his way over the next little while back to where he had buried his family. I can't imagine. And he found that their graves had been disturbed, desecrated. So he ends up gathering up their remains and taking them to a place where the ground is consecrated and burying them again so that they might not have to walk the earth. And this is a very common and typical story that you would hear told by local villagers in different areas about something along those same lines. But it didn't happen just over there. It wasn't just superstition. There's a story that appeared in a Notre Dame alumni website. And this story was told by a gentleman who, in the early 1960s, was working a job in construction. He was a young fella. He was eligible for the draft, but had not yet been drafted. And he was, you know, working in construction in this town he lived in. And he was living at home still with his parents. So one night he's walking along and he's thinking about a friend of his that just sort of popped in his head, a guy by the name of Jerry. And he and Jerry had been friends for a long time, but he hadn't seen Jerry in 2 years because Jerry had been drafted and had been taken to Vietnam. And he was just, you know, wondering, I wonder if he's okay. I wonder how he's doing, you know. And as he's thinking about this, he draws close to this little old cemetery or a funeral parlor that's right along his path. He walks past it every night. But he sees in the doorway a man who looks amazingly like Jerry. And he thinks, oh my God, that is Jerry. And he's just about to open his mouth and call out to him when he gets this really bad feeling in the pit of his stomach. And instead he pulls his hat down lower and just keeps on going. He could feel Jerry's eyes kind of boring into his back. But for some reason, he just knew he didn't want to talk to him. He just didn't, not right now. He gets home and he goes in the house and his mother's literally just hanging up the phone and she said it was a call from so-and-so, somebody that he had known his whole life growing up in this town. And she said, you know that boy Jerry you went to school with? And he said, yes. And she said, well, you know, his mama got notified a few days ago that he had died in the war. And they just brought him home. He's down at the local cemetery. The same cemetery or the local funeral parlor, the same one that he had just passed. And he's being laid out there tomorrow. We might want to go down and pay our respects. And he just stood there in the doorway and stared. And he wondered if his thoughts of his friend had called his friend to him or if his friend was standing in the doorway waiting to be acknowledged and he had looked away. But those stories happen too. There's a lot of them.
That's really curious, though, that he had the feeling that he got the inkling that he didn't want to say anything,
right.
Which that's a bit curious to me, you know, especially if they were friends. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, maybe I don't know what the reason would be for that, but he definitely felt that way and he mm-hmm. chose to ignore his friend. I don't know how he felt about it afterward, you know, when he realized this was maybe his last attempt to, get a chance to say something to his people he knew and loved in his town. But it was what it was. So the next story I found was really interesting to me. It was one of my favorite stories throughout the research process. Now, just so people know what I'm talking about, during the war, the North Vietnamese made an extensive series of tunnels under the ground all over the country in the area that was being fought over. And so the American military decided that they needed people who could go into those tunnels, go after these men or set depth charges and blow them, these areas up and kill whoever was in there. So these people, these soldiers, were called tunnel rats. They were chosen, sadly enough, just because they were small. So if you were short and thin and young and agile, you could very well be volunteered by your commander. And a gentleman makes a point of saying he was told he could volunteer, but his commander told him to volunteer.
And well, being a veteran, I know exactly what that's like. Now, I'm not going to say I was ever in a tunnel. You know, I don't want to say that, but I mean, just the act of being volunteered.
Yep. So he ends up being volunteered. He becomes one of these tunnel rats. And what you do as a tunnel rat is you have to climb through these tunnels, try to not get shot and kill whoever else is in there. And if there's nobody there, then like I said, you set the charge and then you blow the place up and disrupt the network of t- tunnels that the Viet Cong were using to travel across the country, and they would just pop up out of nowhere and, you know, attack people. So it was really a dangerous job. I can't imagine. So this gentleman is now a tunnel rat, and he's partnered up with a young black man named Bino. And Bino's unfortunate characteristics are that he's also a very small man. Mm. And so that, and the only way you can communicate in these tunnels is by touch, because you can't speak, because if there's somebody ahead of you, you don't want to give them a warning that you're coming. So he talks a little bit about their communication system. So if you're the lead man in the front, you would take your toes and tap the head or the helmet of the gentleman behind you to like stop, or there's something, you know, freeze. And they kind of had a little system worked out between them, him and Bino. And if you were in the second position in the behind, you would tap the sole of his boot or his toes and get his attention that you've noticed something is wrong. But you couldn't speak, so they had to do this weird little tapping communication system. And they're ordered to go into this particular tunnel in an area right west of Da Nang, and I cannot imagine how terrifying this had to have been. It was very tight, it was very dark, it was very, it stunk terribly. He thought that perhaps somebody had already died in that tunnel, because you could smell the rotting smell, and he said that that meant that usually somebody had died, or that food had gone really bad down in there, and he didn't know what to expect. As they're crawling through it, the hackles are up on his neck, and he's just, you know, he's scared, and I don't blame him at all. And the tunnel opens into this wide area, like a cavern that they had hollowed out under the ground. And he and Bino are in this area. They have the little red flashlight, they use a flashlight with a red lens. I'm sure you're familiar with it. And they're looking around, and they see a set of steps going way down into the earth. And he said these steps weren't freshly dug. These steps were old, ancient. These had been made hundreds of years ago. You could tell by the weathering and the way they were shaped. And they didn't know what to do. They'd never encountered anything like this. And he looked at Bino, and Bino sort of shrugged, and, you know, and they kind of whispered to each other, what do we do now? And he said, I guess we go down. There's got to be something down there. So they start down these steps. Bino is right behind him, got his back. And as they get down there, they see a little room, and it's very small, almost the size of a little bathroom, you know. And in it are 10 people standing there, all of them Viet Cong. They have uniforms on that, you know, indicate who they are. It's dimly lit by some candles that are placed along the edges of the room. Sitting in the middle of the room is this gorgeous gold statue of a naked woman. She's naked from the waist up. From the waist down, she looks like she has tentacles that are, instead of legs, that are shaped out of the gold and roll just like the tentacles on an octopus. And it's standing there. And these 10 people are standing at attention, looking at this statue. Their eyes are black, just black. There's no white. And they're rocking back and forth on their feet, standing there, just staring at the statue, straight ahead, rocking. No expression. The flashlights, they shine the flashlights on them. They expect them to move. They can see a pile of guns, but they're rusting. Like they've been there a while in that moisture. And these people just standing there, black-eyed, staring at that statue, never moving, never veering, not paying any attention to these two men who could very easily have opened fire and shot them. And Bino grabs his arm and he said, don't shoot them. I've seen this once before down in New Orleans. And, you know, the other guy's shrugging. He's like, what do we do? And he's like, we get out of here. We get out of here. We set a charge. We get out of here. The other guy, the gentleman who's telling the story, he said he had this intense desire to walk up and pick up that statue and touch it. And as he tried to step forward to do that, Bino grabbed his arm and he said, don't touch that. That's evil. We got to get out of here, man. So he pulled his friend and they went up the steps, got out of there, set the charge before they left, moved off into the woods, told the rest of the unit that they were with that, you know, stay out of that area. There's going to be a explosion in 90 minutes. They set it for 90 minutes. They had time to get everybody out. And they blew it up. And he said in his rendition of this that the whole time they were sitting there waiting for it to blow up, that they were praying, him and Bonneau. They were praying, even though they didn't know exactly what they were praying for, that just that these things wouldn't come out of the ground, that whatever they were would find peace, that it was just a horrible, horrible experience. And he said that he had always thought he would take this story to his grave, and he would never tell it to anybody. But then recently he got a diagnosis of being terminally ill with cancer. And suddenly all the things that he thought he was going to keep quiet about, you know, till he died, he didn't want to keep quiet about anymore. And among the things was this story, because he wanted people to know that there's something there. There was, if that statue ever gets discovered, if it surfaces in some way, that it's a bad thing, and it did something terrible to these people. And so he decided to write the story out and put it on a forum and tell it. And it's just a terrifying story, and I have no idea what it would be, but it sounds almost like some sort of demonic entity overtook them.
Did they say how many stairs there were? I mean, was it, you know, a lot or just?
It was, I mean, I've actually seen a picture of a set of stairs cut that way in the same area. It looks like you're going down a couple floors, and then it opened into that little room. And then at the very end of the story, he asked a question. He said, you know, the one thing that I've never been able to figure out is if those people were so hypnotized or, you know, overtaken in some way, who lit the candles? Who replaced them?
But knowing, yeah, I mean, a human being can't survive very many days without water. I mean, you can go a while without food, but not without water. And if their weapons were there long enough to be rusty, yeah, definitely something supernatural.
Yeah, I mean, everything about it was terrifying. And he said he never asked Bonneau, but, you know, what happened in New Orleans, what he saw. Mm-hmm. But he said he had seen this once before in New Orleans, this phenomena, and that they needed to get out. It was evil. And that's all he would ever tell him. He didn't want to talk about it. So I just thought that was a fascinating story. A lot more questions than answers in it.
You're right. Yeah.
But I like stories like that where you have to think and wonder. But not every story is a secret. In Saigon, which is one of the busiest areas in Vietnam, we don't realize today, but there were a lot of people who were living there, American people who were living there. There were soldiers who rented apartments, officers and staff, stuff like that. There were families who came over, like wives that came and followed their husbands and made it that far and would stay there. And when they got a chance, they would, you know, be able to see their loved one. So there actually was a huge series of three buildings that were built in the what's called the Chinatown District in Saigon. And the buildings are high rises. There's no other way to explain them. They're high rise apartment buildings with offices and business space on the lower floors. And they were beautiful, well constructed. They were, you know, should have been popular. There should have been a lot of like shopping malls in them and, you know, doctor's offices, attorneys, all kinds of stuff. But interestingly enough, even though they were originally pretty well filled up, it didn't take long for the buildings to empty out. In fact, two of the buildings, they have nobody in them. They had nobody in them by the 1980s. There was nobody living in them at all. They're just standing there. The third one had only a couple of families, like maybe 20 families in this entire building that were still there. The stories are that they would see an American soldier walking through the buildings, and he had a young Vietnamese woman with him, holding her hand. And the story is that he died in the battle and came back looking for her to lead her, you know, to marry her. He was going to marry her and take her home with him. And that they wander aimlessly through the building now. Another story is that a taxi driver said he was called to pick up a girl. And when he got there, the place was empty. So he called the number on the phone, and all he could hear on the other end was like deep breathing and screams, like muffled screams, like, you know, kind of in the distance. So he was scared by this, and he's like, I don't know what's going on, but it don't sound good, and I don't want any part of it. So he pulled away and went later and told the story to somebody he knew in the area, who told him that was there's a story about a girl who was killed there in 2005 by her boyfriend while they were living in one of the buildings, and that she reaches out to try to get out of there, away from him, by calling for taxis, but she can never complete it. It's almost like the story of Resurrection Mary, where she tries to, you know, to go to the dance that she didn't get to go to because she died in a car accident, or the hitchhiker stories where they're always trying to go home and don't quite make it. But there are a lot of these stories in this building of people who died, you know, terrible deaths, and the buildings are considered extremely haunted. And I just thought it was interesting because we think about maybe a battlefield and what have you. We don't think about apartment complexes, but they're haunted as well. There's a story about a young lady who visits a grocery store. She'll come in, she'll talk to the people at the grocery store, she'll order groceries to be delivered. She goes down the street, she orders a refrigerator to be delivered to the house and gives their address. She pays for it and says she will meet them at the house. So the delivery man shows up with the refrigerator, and of course the other delivery man shows up with his groceries. And when they get to the house, there's an old woman there. They knock on the door and she opens it, and they said, you know, we're here to deliver the goods that were ordered today. And she's like, I didn't order anything. Now, the story's happened several times, so by now she's got the idea of what's going on. And they said, well, you had to. And she starts to cry, and she said, no, that was my daughter. She died almost a year ago, and she was on her way to order a new refrigerator because the refrigerator had gone, and she was going to order groceries so that they could put stuff in the fridge when it got there. And she died on that journey. She was killed, hit by a car. However, here's the weird part. They claim that the delivery driver or the cashier at the stores had the cash. She paid them for it. So it's a physical manifestation.
And that made me wonder then, later on, did that cash just dematerialize? Or was it?
No, from what I can understand, it's the cash was there. They had that as proof, but they never could complete the transaction because she didn't exist anymore. So I just thought that was really an interesting story because, you know, it has that physical component. And it's very much like the hitchhiker stories and stuff like that. You know, in that, you know, she's trying to complete something but can't. It just was bizarre. So there's another building in the area of Saigon that its number was 727. I hope I say this right. Tran Hung Dao in Ho Chi Minh City at the time. And this building was kind of a cursed building. I don't know how she would explain it. You know, there are ships that take people's lives whenever they're being built, and then they become like hoodoo ships, or trains that have several accidents and people die and they become known for being bad luck. And this is what this building's like. So the story goes that the building was built, and when they got to the 13th floor, they added a 13th floor. And this was odd because most places don't do that. Even other countries, the superstition is kind of bled through. And but they did. They added a 13th floor. At that point, that's whenever the tragedies began. People dying, construction workers having horrible accidents, things of that nature. And the Vietnamese people believed that 13 is an unlucky number, so they were very concerned. However, whenever they put the elevator in, they decided to skip the 13th floor button. They just gave it a different name, as what happens in a lot of our buildings in the United States as well. And the people didn't want to rent houses there or apartments there. They just didn't want anything to do with this place. It had a bad reputation before it ever opened its doors. So to kind of soothe everybody's fears and kind of help get this building off on a better footing, the local county commissioner, who had been a big part of this whole process, had, you know, funded this and what have you, decided that he would get a shaman to address any possible problems, that the shaman would come in and do blessings, everybody would be happy, it would all be good. So he gets a shaman to come in and do this. The problem is that there's a tradition in some quarters of Vietnam that in order to protect a building, you have to place four virgins, one on each of the four corners of the building. So he literally went to a morgue and took four young ladies who had passed away. He bought them and buried them on the four corners of the building instead of doing like prayers and what have you. And it's said that this building is so badly haunted, nobody wants to live there. People hear whispers, they hear screams, the sound of a military parade going by, and an American soldier walking through with guns, that only three of the bodies have been recovered. Of those four young ladies, the fourth one is still there. They can't seem to find it. And the place continues to be badly haunted, and people just simply don't want to live there. And I can't say I blame them.
No, I mean, and I had heard, and I don't know how true this is, but because of triskaidekaphobia, or the fear of the number 13, that when buildings were built, they made a 13th floor, but it was like 6 inches tall.
Oh, I never heard that one.
Okay. And that, you know, that's why you would see the elevator go from 12 to 14, and you wouldn't see a but there was a 13th floor, but it was so small that nobody could occupy it. So if anybody knows about that, please let us know. I mean, yeah. Was that an urban legend that I heard? But yeah, I seem to recall an awful lot of stuff.
That's my whole life. My brain is filled with random stuff that just comes flying out at odd moments. Okay. But no, I just thought it was fascinating because, you know, it's the land was haunted. It looks like it there, you know, because it the soldiers and stuff would have been from before the building was built, and then everything else just continues, you know, from there. It's just an interesting story, but not all the stories from Vietnam are just ghost stories. I want to touch a little wee bit on the amount of bizarre crypto stories and UFO stories that came out of this war. Now, we've heard a few stories about rock apes, which are supposed to be these apes that the American soldiers encountered. I wanted to talk a little bit about that because I thought they were fascinating. So these are called the Batutuit or the Uti. And that's what their names are. It means they're also known as the Ngoi Rung. And again, I apologize if I'm butchering this. I'm doing my best to say it phonetically. But it means the people of the forest. These stories have long been there. Now, this is why I found this story interesting, because they describe these creatures. And it says that they are hairy, ape-like, covered in reddish hair or fur, very muscular, and only about 5 foot tall. Very distinctive ape-like features. Of course, in Vietnam, there are no naturally occurring primates, no apes or anything of that nature.
Didn't know that.
They are widely, or were widely reported by American soldiers. They called them rock apes because these things had a propensity for throwing rocks at them, and sometimes boulders. I mean, like they could pick up very heavy things. The Viet Cong that we've come to later find out after the war was over, also were seeing them. Because at one point it was actually postulated that these might just have been people in costumes that the Viet Cong were using. So they used a lot of mind games and stuff like that. And so that was a possibility. But later on, it would be discovered after the war was over that the Viet Cong thought that the Americans were doing the same thing, very much like the Foo Fighters in World War II, where, you know, the Japanese thought that we had these bizarre things that were zipping up to them, these little things, and they didn't know what they were. And then we found out later that we had seen them, and we thought the Japanese had them. So it was along the same lines in that respect. They were not only haunted, like they haunted the woods, but they, like I said, they attacked people, they threw rocks, but they did a lot of other crazy things too. And we're gonna, you know, over the course of time, if you're really interested in it, I'd like to share like a half dozen stories sometime. Let me know, guys, because there are so many cryptid stories you wouldn't believe. So there's, that's just one of many cryptids that have been observed. There's a soldier by the name of Craig Thompson from Idaho, who, and he gives his infantry and everything, and he tells this story. He says that he and his platoon had been on the Bong Son River, and they came across this area where the water, they get down in the water and kind of wash up and what have you. And as they're cleaning themselves up, they notice this enormous snake-like creature going through the water. It's undulating, you know, side to side like a snake swimming, but it's huge. He describes it as being about 30 feet long, 2 feet wide, with a huge squared head, gold scales that glistened in the sun. And its body had a dorsal plume of some sort that jutted from the water as it swam. The dorsal plume was a dark red color. He said it was the most bizarre thing he'd ever seen. Somebody saw it and called everybody's attention to it. They started trying to hurry to get out of the water because this thing was coming in their direction. And they panicked and got out of the water and began to shoot at this thing as it was headed in their direction. And he said that it went beneath the murky water and disappeared. Didn't seem to be fazed by the bullets. And he said he's, you know, over the course of his lifetime, he's wondered about what it was. There is something over there called an oarfish, which can be like 36 feet long. And often people see them and think they're sea serpents, but he said it didn't fit the description of what they had seen when he actually looked one up. So whatever it is, it's a fascinating creature. There are stories of giant spiders. These spiders are literally the size of a Volkswagen, an old Beetle. They were seen, they're described as large, green, with tube-like legs that come out onto the road from the middle of nowhere. Soldiers encountered them on multiple occasions and reported them. They had webs that you could literally get caught in as a human being. If you can imagine a web so thick and sticky that a human being could get caught like a fly.
No, thank you.
No, not a spider person, huh?
Nope.
Yeah, there are just so many bizarre things. Giant reptiles, all kinds of crazy things. Now, there's one that I thought was really fascinating. Was this happened on December the 17th, 1974. A platoon of soldiers was out on a search and destroy mission in the DMZ. They had penetrated a heavily wooded area near a riverbank. And they noticed that it was very quiet in the jungle. Like a jungle is usually loud. There's birds and you know, all the noise and squeaking and squawking and what have you that goes on and with all that animals out there. But this jungle was dead silent. Obviously, because, you know, you're in a war zone, you're thinking there's a reason everything's quiet. Something's wrong. There's something out here. So the soldiers were obviously on alert, antsy, looking around. They come across these piles of excrement, huge piles of excrement. no footprints, just this piles of poo. And they're huge. I mean, there's a lot there. They're looking around wondering if there's an animal in the brush that's big, that's kind of keeping an eye on them. And that's when they see something up in the trees. And you'll know why I think this one's fascinating, because it's up in the trees. So it says that they looked and they saw several humanoid creatures lurking up in the trees. They were like nothing they had seen before. He describes them. I'm just going to read his description. The creatures were estimated to be about 8 foot high, with bright yellow coloration and three-fingered hands that ended in wicked-looking talons. The faces of these beasts were flat and sported large eyes with only a couple of slits for a nose. Giant yellow-skinned beings that were reported as passing right by the platoon. He says they literally jumped down out of the trees and took off right past his platoon, not paying any attention to them at all, as if they weren't even of any importance. They just came out of the trees and started marching off in the same direction. He said the soldiers were frightened and they began to shoot. These things didn't even turn around, whatever they were. The bullets bounced off them. And he said that whatever this was, it scared them so bad because nothing was, you know, wasn't penetrating, that they weren't, nothing happened when you shot them. Even when there was an armor-piercing gun brought up, it didn't damage them at all. They just kept moving. The soldiers broke ranks and took off running in the opposite direction. As they're crashing through the brush, they said they suddenly realized that there was something crashing behind them. And they realized that these things, these giant whatever they were, with the yellow skin, were following them.
So much for not important, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. At that point, they could hear the things closing in, crashing. It was getting much, much closer. They headed for the boat that they had just gotten off of and managed to get on board the boat, screaming for the captain to push it away from the water, get it away from the water, get it away, you know, into the water, further back into the water. And they saw that there were dozens of these on the shore, standing there watching them leave. And the people on the boat who had not been privy to the rest of it saw them too.
Certainly a unique description. I mean, as many of the stories you've told before, nothing has sounded like that. Not even the tree people. Yeah.
Yeah. Now I know two stories. There is a story I talked about a creature in my UFO book. Okay. UFOs in Pennsylvania. Where there was something like that. And in the cryptid book, we talk about, which were monsters in PA, the fact that there was a being, a creature sighted, excuse me, at one point in time in Pennsylvania that was described as dung yellow, large and hairy with matted fur that was dung yellow. That's one thing. Now, here's what I thought. I have long heard that the movie Predator was based on a compilation of events from soldiers during the war. What if? Think about it. There's a lot of parallels to that movie and that sighting. These things are large, moving from through the trees. They're not able to be killed by the bullets. The facial features, the slits for the nose, the flat faces, and their super fast ability to move. It just, like, there were components of it that jiggled my brain, and I was like, I wonder if this is one of the stories that impacted that.
Maybe. I mean, when you were talking about the large piles of excrement, mm-hmm. all I could think back to was the one scene in Jurassic Park where Jeff Goldblum's character saw the pile, and he said, that's a big pile of... I don't know if you saw that movie.
Yeah, I've seen it. Yeah, you're right. When at one point, he plunges his hand into it or something, I think.
Oh, that was the other dude. Yeah, they was trying to get the phone that was out of it.
Yeah. It's been a year since I've seen it, but I do remember seeing it. Then I came across this bizarre story. So these are... the story is actually being told by guards, you know, soldiers who were on guard duty in this one area. They were Marines, and it's told by a gentleman by the name of Earl Morrison, who was part of the series of events. So it was, they were on guard duty. They started to notice a weird glow in the sky. It got closer and closer and closer, and then they started to hear what sounded like wings flapping, but loud, very large. As they look up, they see that it is a being, a female being, that it's naked with long flowing hair and totally black skin. And it casts an eerie green glow off of its skin. It was completely silent other than the flapping sound, and it moved slowly and purposefully, he said. He said everything glowed when this thing was around, not just it, but everything around it, like it picked up that light, and it glowed with radiance. Where the arms, he said, and I'm going to read this part. We saw her arms toward the wings, and they looked like regular molded arms, each with a hand and fingers and everything, but they had skin from the wings going over them. She flapped her wings, and there was no noise at first. It looked like her arms didn't have bones in them because they were as limber as the wings of a bat. And it came closer and closer as they were there. Suddenly, it was only about 7 foot above their heads. She blotted out the moon, and they stared, trying to make sense out of what they were seeing. There was no sound, nothing at all. And then she stopped. She stared at him for a few seconds, hovering, like a hummingbird would hover, and began to make her way away after she had watched them. It maybe lasted 3 to 4 minutes, her hovering above them. When they talked about it, somebody, one of the local people, came to them and said, "You shouldn't talk about those. Those are the night flyers. They're winged humanoids that will swoop down and take you. You must be sure never to talk about them, because if you talk about them, you will call them up and they will come and get you and they will eat you."
All right. I'm not going to talk about it.
The fascination of this thing, think about what we're talking about here.
Yeah, to hover.
It's beyond the capabilities of anything. I mean, there's not even very many flying winged creatures we know of, just the hummingbird, that can do that. It can just stop and hover and stay in one spot, usually drinking nectar. But this thing could hover for 3 to 4 minutes, watching them, just staring at them curiously. I just thought it was a fascinating story. So this next story, takes place very near the end of the war. So people think that the catalyst for the entry into the war, had a political nature, and there's probably a truth to the fact that there was a component of it. However, there is an event that happened that convinced the Americans that they needed to end their involvement in Vietnam. So we know of it as the Gulf of Tonkin incident. Took place in August of 1964, and supposedly, it was also called the USS Maddox incident. The United States had a destroyer ship that had been put under attack by the North Vietnamese, and it helped serve to force the United States Congress to pass the Tonkin Resolution and give the President Lyndon Johnson the authority to increase military police presence in Vietnam. That's what sort of started the whole thing. This particular event, whatever it was, is what put 59,000 soldiers over there to die. American soldiers, there were about 59,000 who died there. There's another 1,600 who never came home, missing in action. And it has all been kind of wrapped up in a mystery as to what happened, because the American soldiers in this event reported that whatever this craft was that the Viet Cong were driving, it moved like nothing they had ever seen before. It could shoot in one direction and then shoot in another direction, hover. It was a large circular craft that moved in ways that defied gravity. Hold on. So this mystery gets wrapped up inside of all of this, and it's not talked about for quite a while. So the USS Maddox had been outperforming all the ships that the Viet Cong were able to, you know, put up against it until this day. When this day was over, the USS aircraft had been damaged. They had come in to help. Three North Vietnamese torpedo boats were damaged. Four North Vietnamese sailors were killed. The USS Maddox and another destroyer called the Turner Joy had been damaged, and this is what created this interest. To this day, we don't know what that craft was that they thought the Viet Cong were driving. In 1966, a Navy sonar engineer assigned to the destroyer USS Turner Joy came forward with a rather odd event that he claimed nobody talked about. He said that on the day of the second of the day of the Tonkin attack, he picked up signatures on his radar of enemy torpedoes, but which behaved erratically and were under intelligent control, approaching the ship and then going under it only to dart off and then return, like they were almost like a dolphin moving around under the water. That both the vessels reported detecting small, fast-moving objects on radar, both above and below the surface of the water. They took them to be torpedoes and torpedo boats. The visibility was low, and they couldn't tell what they were. There were over 20 of them spotted on the sonar and radar. They did not behave like a torpedo. They moved at will, darting around, not going in a straight line. You know, if you shoot a torpedo, it just keeps going straight. None of that makes any sense. They were illuminated. You could see the glow from them. Others said that they had seen the cockpit lights of the enemy vessels in the gloom, and that in the wake of these torpedoes, there were strange sounds like propellers of torpedoes, but no impacts occurred to any ship from any of them. Two American destroyers performed evasive maneuvers, unloaded 650 cannon shells, depth charges, blew the area to absolute hell, as I quote the gentleman. And yet, when the smoke cleared, there were no enemy vessels, no wreckage, no debris. Nothing could account for this. The destroyer crews were adamant that this occurred, that they had been under attack, and this was the event that propelled the United States into the war. They were told not to talk about it, that it didn't happen, that it was gossip. The U.S. Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, himself conceded that there were no enemy attacks on that day. But even the President, Johnson, said, "For all I know, our Navy was shooting at whales out there," admitting there was something out there they couldn't explain. The destroyer's crews continued to insist that there had been something menacing them, that they had seen it, that they had heard it, that they had experienced it. The military countered this by saying this was a combination of weather and schools of fish near the surface. When that didn't fly, pardon the pun, it was birds, sensor problems, possibly all of them, misidentifying phantom targets, that what they saw was their imagination. The military insisted that what they claimed they saw were not UFOs or USOs under the surface. I just think this is fascinating that the military went to such great lengths to hide it, and it took years for it to come out. They have paid officials, scientists, botanists, biologists, hired by the military to counter these crews' narratives, saying everything from it was schools of fish to bugs. I just found this story amazing. So anybody who ever wonders, you know, what's going on and if there's UFOs, think about this story. We got into a war. I don't care what you want to call it. It's a war. Based upon the fact that 20 phantom ground-blowing objects attacked two United States destroyers. That the destroyers threw 650 rounds at them, sent off depth charges, had air fire, nothing damaged them, and they all went away. And it propelled us into a bloody and bitter conflict, which I might add is filled with UFO stories. There are so many UFO stories about glowing lights, hovering metallic craft, watching ships in the ocean, hovering above soldiers on the battlefield. If you guys are interested, again, let me know. We can tell the tales. But I am completely fascinated by the paranormal component of what happened over in Vietnam. Obviously, there was geopolitical issues going on, other things happening. But beyond all of that, there are things that they can't explain. One of the reasons, I was reading some stuff about the rock apes. One of the reasons that they claim that, at least this author claimed, that they actually did the Agent Orange to kill the defoliate the ground wasn't just because of the Viet Cong, it was because of the rock apes. They were attacking the soldiers in so many places, so in order to deal with it, before they would go in, they would drop the Agent Orange and then they would flamethrower the area, kill off everything there, and either kill them or drive them out in the, you know, because it's a devastated area now. And then the soldiers could go through. That there are so many possible paranormal and cryptid reasons for what was going on over there and how this all wove together to create this horrible war just was truly amazing to learn about. I learned about it in a way I had never learned about it before.
Almost like it was designed by a higher power.
Yeah, think. Yep. Somebody put us in that position, and then, I mean, we could have still chosen to not declare war. And I won't tell you that I think very much of Johnson as a president. He was not a good man, and he was not a good president. And I think there are records that indicate that he chose to do this for financial reasons as well. So, you know, because the military-industrial complex, it was going to make him famous. It was going to be the president who did, you know, who succeeded, but he didn't. But beyond all of that, to find out all this paranormal stuff that was going on under the surface. And we're talking about two groups of highly trained soldiers on destroyer ships who have adamantly refused to back down to the military to this day. That's an interesting story in my book.
Agreed.
With that, I am done.
I enjoyed every single one of those.
I'm glad.
Okay. And what people don't know is that quite a few of those you had to tell twice because, again, we were both distracted, but it was my fault for not clicking the record button. So,
yeah, so you just made me practice, that's all.
We got a little bit of practice. Yeah, that's true. So, yeah.
So, but yeah, I just thought this was amazing. I had no idea. I fell into it. I was actually looking for a story for my supernatural life, which I do on WordPress. And I was telling a story about I told you the story before about the statue of the weary American soldier that sits in this cemetery and how he gets up and walks and what have you. So I wanted to do some stuff on that. And I actually have photographs if anybody wants to go over to it. I don't normally plug that, but I do a blog on there and it's called My Supernatural Life. And you just look me up that way or my name, Patty A. Wilson. And I actually have photos of the statue and stuff like that on there. So you can check that out if you're interested.
I can put that link on the link tree.
Okay. And I don't think about that stuff. I apologize. But that's what got me started. And then I'm looking up all the material on that. And then I start falling into these other stories. And I'm like, oh, man, I got to tell these stories. They're just too good to just bury again. Like I said, that's just the tiniest of samplings. I didn't even get anywhere near all the cryptids. I only told you one UFO story. And there's literally hundreds of ghost stories that I haven't told. I just picked some of my favorites.
Speechless. Yeah.
It was really cool. That's one of the nice parts about doing the podcast is I get to spend a whole week like delving into something really cool. Sometimes most of the time I don't know what it's going to be until like the day before. And I just fall into a big old hole and start rooting around and come up with these amazing stories.
All right. Well, thank you for all the stories, Patty. And I think we'll say good night.
Good night.